this morning's talk is on the fifth precept. With mindfulness clear and radiant, I purify my mind. Or I undertake the training precept of abstaining from taking intoxicants that cloud the mind. And in some ways I find it slightly humorous whenever I talk about mindfulness, because I used to be the sort of person where, so when I lived in Sheffield, my main form of transport was a bicycle, and I'd quite regularly try and get on my bike and ride it away without having unchained it from the railings. So just the sort of, you know, me getting out of the house was a constant, I've lost my keys, I've lost my wallet. So I have come a very, very long way with mindfulness, but it could not be said that it's a strong area for me. Yes. Nonetheless. Right, so I'm going to start off with a poem, and it's a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye called The Art of Disappearing. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem. Greasy sausage balls on a paper plate. Then reply. If they say, "We should get together," say why. It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees. The monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognises you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk round feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. So, I really like that poem, and it's a bit pokey as well. But it's that line, you're trying to remember something too important to forget. So what we're going to look at is, well, for a start, you've spotted we're taking the precepts out of order on this retreat, and we're actually looking at the mindfulness precept first. So why? Why are we doing that? Then we're going to have a little look at, well, what is mindfulness? And then, seeing how the time's going, we're going to explore a bit about confession and rejoicing. And the reason is because, well, confession is us becoming aware, becoming mindful, recollecting that actually we're somewhere we didn't want to be, or we've done something we didn't want to do. And rejoicing is becoming aware that, hey, that was great. Look what we just did, or look what they just did. How amazing. So they're both very sort of linked to mindfulness. So that's where we're going. So we've got why are we taking mindfulness first? There's a few reasons. I mean, actually, when I was thinking about this retreat the first time I ran it, I was just like, well, we've got to have that one first. Like, what else can you do? You've got to start with mindfulness. So first, because all our actions are coming from the mind. All our actions are coming from the mind. So, you know, it sort of starts off with our own internal thoughts and emotions, and, you know, we sort of think that's private and it's just going on inside, but at the same time, a mental action, that is still an action, that is still creating karma, that is still creating habit and grooves in our being. And of course, this is why meditation is so important. You know, meditation is a karmic act. It helps us create the minds that will arise in the future. And then we've got speech. So like speech, that's an act of mind that's had sufficient volition to come out of our mouths. And of course, sometimes we're quite aware of that. And if you're anything like me, quite often I open my mouth, a load of stuff comes out, and then I think, oh. Maybe that wasn't quite what I intended. Or actually, the problem is, it was what I intended. But, you know, do I want those intentions to be coming out of my mouth quite often? Not. So Hajitara will be exploring this further later in the week. And then we've got our behaviour, like our acts of body. And of course, those, they're acts of mind with sufficient weight, not just to come out of our mouths, but we actually physically do the action, whether it's generosity. We don't just think, oh yeah, I'd like to be generous. We actually give that person our spare lettuce or whatever. Or else the reverse, we think, God, I really fancy them, and then we sleep with them, and then we think, oh. But it's all starting from the mind. It's all starting from the mind. So, in a way, well, if we're not present to what's going on for us, what hope have we got with the rest of the precepts? Not a lot. So then we've also got mindfulness as key or core to ethics. Because as we were looking at yesterday, well, what makes our actions skillful or unskillful? And, you know, you can spend hours of confusion kind of going, trying to work out what exactly the right thing is to do, or was that the right thing, or should we have done the right thing? And there's a very, there's a lovely simplicity to being able to come back and think, well, what was my intention? Did I have a generous intention? Did I have a loving intention? Or actually, like, was there something else going on under there? You know, was I giving a bit of a dig at the same time as trying to be generous? So, this is me trying to stop myself introducing a list that we're not doing. but anyway, yeah, so Dharma Vichaya is investigation of mental states, and it is key to the practice of ethics, and actually just to the practice of the Dharma, because if we are not aware of, is what's going on in our mind based in greed, hatred and delusion? Or is it based in love, awareness, truth? If we're not aware of that, actually, not much else is going to happen. So mindfulness, totally fundamental, totally fundamental. Okay, now I'm going to tell you a story. I don't know where this story is from. It was passed on to me through the oral tradition of Sheffield Buddhist Centre. I suspect it of being Tibetan, but I don't really know. So the story is about... So this is a serious Dharma practitioner, and he's a hermit, and he's living in a cave somewhere or other in the mountains. And he's very serious about his ethical practice, and he's, you know, he's doing loads of meditation and puja and you name it. And there's a family in the local village that bring this hermit food. And there's a 17-year-old girl who quite often brings him food. And this lass, she falls in love with the hermit. I mean, you know, he's so sexy and he's so present and he just looks at you with these great eyes. And anyway, so she falls completely in love with him. And so one day when she's bringing him his food, she says, look, there's just you and me here. Like, why don't we just sleep together? You know, we could just enjoy it. You know, it'd be great. And the hermit says, oh, no, you know, I've taken a vow of celibacy and, you know, I'm here on retreat and I'm doing this 3-year retreat and I, you know, I don't want to break it. You know, but I'm really sorry. You know, it's not, you know, you're a lovely lass, but I just don't want to, okay? And so the girl goes away, all sort of disappointed and feeling rejected. And she comes back the next day and she's leading a little kid goat. And she says to the hermit, well, look, okay, you don't want to sleep with me, don't worry about that, but you know, let's just be friends. You know, I'll kill the goat and we can make a delicious goat stew and, you know, we can just eat it together like friends. And the hermit says, oh, well, look, I'm really sorry, but actually, you know, I'm trying to practice the first precept. You know, I'm vegetarian. You know, it's a lovely little goat. I don't want to kill it and eat it. But he feels really bad about, like, letting the girl down because, you know, she's just doing her best, isn't she? So the girl goes back down the hill with the goat. And the next day, she comes back and she's got a skin full of rice beer. And she says, okay, you won't sleep with me. You won't eat goat stew with me, but look, let's just have a drink. And the hermit thinks, oh, well, okay, look, you know, I've said no to her twice. You know, what difference is a glass of rice beer going to make? So they have a glass of rice beer, then they have another, then they have another, then they kill the goat and eat it, and then they have sex. So you can probably see where that story's going. Which is, when we've totally lost mindfulness, actually all the other precepts get broken at the same time. So in a sense, you could probably take most of the precepts and say this, but you know, with mindfulness clear and radiant, you could say that if that was our only precept, basically, like, that would do it. You know, it sort of it can encompass all of the others, and if we lose awareness, actually, like, the next thing we know, we're like, oh, yes. See, it's a good story, even if I don't know where it's from. Yeah. So what we do with our minds is significant. It is significant. And I'm going to explore here the difference between karma and karma vipaka. And this whiteboard is purely for me having written up words in old Buddhist languages. I'm not sure which they are. So, karma vipaka at the bottom there. So, yesterday we explored karma. Karma simply meaning action, and specifically meaning volitional action, our conscious choices, which actually can also feel like unconscious because it's like the whole directionality of our mind, but it's the actions that we are choosing to do. And the reason that I think this difference between karma and karma vipaka is quite important to bring in here is because, you know, I've just been talking about what goes on in our minds is really important and how important it is to distinguish between, you know, are the skillful mental states in our minds or are the unskillful mental states in our minds. And of course that is really important. It's not that it's not important. But what it means is that we can start giving ourselves a hard time about stuff that arises in our experience that we think, oh no, this is greed, hatred and delusion. And then we can think, well, but I should blame myself and I should... okay, so there I am sitting meditating it's the fourth stage of the metta bhavana and I realise I'm furious with this person, I'm furious with them, or whatever it might be, and then oh no, this is based in ill will, I'm a bad Buddhist, or whatever it might be. And, you know, so this goes for, you know, any emotion or thought that we've got arising in our minds where we think, quite often we think, I don't want this. And we can see that it's not going to lead to a good place, necessarily. But, so there's a key distinction here, because, a lot of the time, thoughts and emotions, as they just initially arise in our minds, what they are is vipaka. They are karma vipaka. So karma... the current actions, what we're choosing now. And karma vipaka means the fruit of actions. Vipaka is fruit or result. And that is the result of past actions, choices, old conditioning, old habits, old patterns. And that is just arising based on stuff that has happened to us in the past and choices we have made in the past. And that is just bubbling up. It's not like we're choosing that in this moment. It just comes up. And actually, there is nothing we can do about that in the moment. Do you get the distinction? So I am a person with quite a strong tendency towards irritability and ill will. So when I lose it in meditation, usually I am sitting in meditation and I'm writing angry emails to people, or I'm rehearsing what I'm going to say to that person in that argument I'm about to have when I get off the cushion and go and tell them what I think. Okay, so you know, that tendency will arise in me, and I can't just sit here and go, I don't want to have that tendency. It's like, well, I do have that tendency. There's nothing I can do about that. But the choice that I do have is, okay, that arises. I notice, oh, awareness. I'm writing another snippy email. And at that point, that's the fresh karma, where do I choose to spend the rest of the meditation going over and over how I could make the best cutting comment? Or do I actually think, oh, and this experience is ill will. Can I feel it in my body? What is that like? Do I want to pursue this? Will it lead to happiness? I think not. And so that's a very, very useful thing to notice in looking at ethics. So it's sort of like what bubbles up, but then looking at, like, okay, what are the choices we're then making? And can we actually not compound what's bubbling up by it then going, and I'm such a bad person for having that envy or that craving or that lust or, you know, whatever it might be. Are you getting the distinction? Because it is quite, if it's still a bit kind of like, ooh, how is that? Like, take it to your groups and talk about it there, because it's very interesting to look at that, you know, with actual examples. Oh, what bit of that was Vipaka and what bit of that was fresh karma? And of course, it's not, you know, over time, we are changing those habits. So it's like, now I have much less of a habit of irritability and ill will than I had 10 years ago. But it's that whole sort of geography of our minds thing, you know, the riverbeds of habit. And geography changes slowly over time. It doesn't just, you know, you can't just kind of wake up one morning and go, I won't be that person. So... So this is Bantu from Know Your Mind. The important thing, whatever the emotional state we are in, is to know that we are experiencing it. If we can become aware of our whole emotional life in this way, we will find that this has a twofold effect. Our negative emotions will tend to be dissolved, or at least brought very much under control, and our positive emotions will tend to be refined still further. So awareness itself is a karmic act. Awareness itself is creating a habit of further awareness. And just by itself, it helps to dissolve unskillful emotions and unskillful habits. Okay, so what is mindfulness? Now, probably we all think we know this one, and probably to a large extent we do. But I'm particularly going to... there's particular areas that get focused on and others that I think get slightly lost. So, and a lot of this is from Living with Awareness, Bhante's book Living with Awareness. So we've got these three words up on the board that get used for mindfulness in the Buddhist tradition. So we've got sati, samprajanya, and apamada. So starting off with sati. See, let's forget the notes. It's like, I can't stand mindfulness. It does my head in. And I think there's something about the word where, like, this is just personal, okay? Can you tell this is personal? This isn't fancy. There's something about the word mindfulness where I think I've just dropped asleep with boredom by the time I've finished saying it. But there's aspects of mindfulness that actually I do find much more exciting. So quite often these do get used very interchangeably in the tradition, and you just have to sort of think, oh, what sense is this being used in? But how Bhante talks about it is he talks about sati as recollection or memory. And I really like this. I really like this. So he talks about it as both recollection of the past, because in a way, like, the present only makes sense in the context of, like, who we are as human beings, you know, where we've come from, and who we are now. It's like, it's the result of, you know, what we are and everything that's happened and our choices in the past. And that's what gives significance to the present moment. So it's being aware of that, the significance of the present moment. And then we have, well, the present moment itself. And of course, this is the way in which, I mean, nowadays, if you say the word mindfulness, usually people think that that just refers to being aware in the present moment, non-judgmentally, which is one of its meanings. So physical experience, emotional experience, thoughts, reality, just now, just this. And, you know, that is a very important aspect of mindfulness. So we've had mindfulness of the past, mindfulness of the present moment, and then also mindfulness of the future. And at this point we go more into the Samprajanya area. So Bhante translates Samprajanya as mindfulness of purpose. And Anālio, don't worry if you don't know who he is, translates it as clear comprehension. And the reason it relates to the future is because, it's having a clear idea that how we act now has a bearing on the future. So how does Bhante put it? He says, everything we do should be done with a sense of the direction we want to move in. We can be quite sure that what we do now will have a decisive effect on what will happen in the future. I am talking, of course, about karma. That's from Living with Awareness. So this mindfulness of purpose thing, it's like we're coming back to what we were talking about at the start of the retreat, about staying in touch with our vision, staying in touch with, like, the bigger picture of our lives. You know, where do we want our lives to go? Who do we want to be? You know, how do we want to live in the world? And keeping in touch with that all the time. Again, Bhante. One might say that it is going about one's daily life without ever forgetting one's higher purpose. And actually, you can see that even when we're looking at mindfulness in the present, you know, that kind of like, what are the sensations in my stomach at the moment? Can I feel my feet? Even that, it requires a sense of samprajanya, of knowing why you are doing that. Because actually, you know, like, if you don't have a sense of, like, well, why is it, you know, what's the significance of returning again and again to the sensations of breathing? If we don't have a sense of, like, why we're doing that, actually, well, for a start, we won't do it. That's the, you know, we just won't. So if we can stay connected to our motivation and the bigger picture, that is the larger sense of mindfulness. Can we stay mindful in that sense? And then, in a way, all the rest will follow. Everything else will do it. And then we've got this word appamada, which again I rather like. And this is the Buddha's final words, where he says, with mindfulness, strive on. So he doesn't say, with noticing the sensations in your big toes, strive on. It's like appamada, which means it means non-drunkenness. So we can think of ourselves when we're unmindful. It's like we're staggering around the world like drunkards, sort of like hitting our head on things and knocking things over and causing chaos and not realising and damaging ourselves and, you know, and not even... Have you ever had that thing where you're drunk and you wake up the next morning and, like, it feels like your whole shoulder's been wrenched and you think, oh, yeah, I did do something funny last night. Sometimes, you know, you don't even realise how you're damaging yourself until... you know, we start coming out of the state of drunkenness. Yeah, so we've got appamada as non-drunkenness, and Banti again. Mindfulness in a special active sense. It is to keep up mindful attention in order to guard against unskillful action. So again, all the time, we're kind of going, oh yeah, where is this leading me? Where is this leading me? It's like an ethical awareness in every moment. Is this going to take me to a good place? Is this not going to be good? And just keeping on touching in with that. So I must say, I love for myself this very ethical aspect of mindfulness, of recollection. So here's a question you might want to ask yourselves. Do we actually have a sense that unmindfulness is unethical and mindfulness is ethical? As strongly as we might have the sense that, like, harming is unethical and acting out of love is ethical. The reason that I'm saying it is because I think I don't. Okay, I think I just think, oh, I can feel my, you know, quite often I can feel my own resistance. I don't want to be aware. I just want to, like, read a trashy novel that I've read six times before and eat chocolate. You know, I don't want to know my mind. I don't, you know, I don't care. Just go away. I don't want to know. You know. And I don't feel, you know, I have to bring myself consciously to an awareness that actually mindfulness is ethical. And if I am consciously cultivating unmindfulness in my life, that is as serious and as significant as if I was going around killing or stealing or, you know, lying or something like that. I mean, it's interesting because in a way it's like we can notice what we are careful with. You know, are we careful of what we eat? Are we careful of, like, taking enough exercise? You know, we're working with, like, the laws of physics and chemistry and biology all the time. But do we really take care of what we put in our minds? In the same way as we, you know, what we put in our bodies, what do we put in our minds? I think Facebook instantly comes to mind, actually. I mean, you know, the classic ones are about drugs and alcohol. You know, obviously, getting drunk, not really in line with the precept. Drugs, not totally in line with the precept. Whereas I think, like, nowadays, a lot of the area that Mindfulness Clear and Radiant is looking at, I mean, a lot of it is around the area of, well, technology, how much time do we spend surfing the internet, how much time do we spend on Facebook, and also, like, well, how much of it is benign, because, like, a lot of Facebook is benign, you know, it's pictures of people's dinners and grandchildren and, like, a selfie of them on the beach, you know, a lot of it's very sort of benign, and yet even that, if you do that for, like, hours, actually, like, it can just be a way of blotting out our experience, and, you know, a way that actually a much more socially acceptable Buddhist way of blotting out our experience is just to sit on Facebook. So, you know, there's a sort of benign side which still has quite an effect on our minds. I mean, you know, just try doing it and see how your mind feels afterwards. Try doing something different and see how your mind feels afterwards. But actually, there are aspects of like Facebook chat groups, and it's like they are poisonous. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like taking pure poison and putting it in your mind. You know, the levels of anger, blame, hatred, ill will, polarization, it is poison. And you know, obviously, like there's always a balance between, like, you know, wanting to know what's going on and choosing what you put in your mind, but like just notice the effect that it has on your psyche and then how you then act having put that in your mind. Just notice, be aware of that, and make conscious choices. Yeah. Whatever that Windows shop is, I noticed the tagline is actually "Do more things at the same time." I was like, "No way!" Really? They think that's a good thing? Yeah. So I feel like technology is a really massive area that is just totally increasing. Yeah, this whole sort of phone addiction thing, where it's like there's the constant checking: has someone sent a message? Has someone sent a message? It's almost like a sort of modern tick that's like this. Again, it's like, I'm so, you know, make your own choices, folks, but like, just look at the effect that it has on the level of our consciousness and then think, well, am I choosing to do that? Consciously choose what you're doing. Just don't just go along with stuff because, you know, your work colleagues are doing it or your friends are doing it. Yep. So, can we notice the effects in ourselves of unmindfulness and mindfulness? Because actually, like, nothing happens because somebody else tells you it's a good idea, or it might happen for like 2.5 weeks, but it won't happen long term. So the point at which I stopped drinking alcohol, and I wasn't ever a person particularly with a problem with alcohol, but the point at which I stopped drinking alcohol was when I realised that if I'd gone out to a friend's and I'd had a few glasses of wine the night before, I'd really noticed how it affected my meditation the next morning. I'd just be sort of like fuzzy and floaty and kind of a bit disconnected, and like I really noticed it had a direct effect on the level of on my level of consciousness the next day, you know. And at that point, I just thought, actually, I value my meditation above social drinking. And at that point, I just thought, actually, I don't want to do it. And now it becomes actually quite unpleasant to me, you know, even if it's just like half a glass of wine. The actual sensation of losing awareness has ceased to be pleasant. But, like, don't do it because I say. Do you see what I mean? Like, look in your experience. Like, notice, well, what are the effects of what we do with our minds? And then also, like, noticing, well, the positive effects of being mindful. And again, like, for some people this is really obvious, and then for others it's more like, you know, they're going to have to go around the houses to work out a connection. For me, I really struggle to get a meditation practice, a daily meditation practice. And it's like, I do it for 2 days, and then, no. I do it for 3 days, no. And the point that cracked it for me was like, well, actually, we had an urban retreat at Sheffield. I'm not going to go into what that is, but if you ever get a chance to go on one. And I meditated for 15 minutes every morning. And as far as I was concerned, the only thing that happened in that 15 minutes was I went through all the things that I thought I needed to do at work that day. You know, we are not talking Diana. I mean, I wouldn't have said that I was present for any of it, actually. It was just like I was sitting there and I was just kind of going, oh, I must do that. And yet, when I'd done it for that week, like, somehow my week went better. And somehow my day at work just seemed to go better if I'd sat for 15 minutes on the cushion and been totally distracted. And I was just like, oh. So clearly it can't be related to whether or not you're having a good meditation. It's like there was obviously something happening that was so not about whether or not I was concentrated. So from that point, it's like I'd made my own connection with why that helps, and actually I've never lost that since. Even though sometimes I also can have, I've also got quite a strong tendency towards anxiety, and you know, sometimes it can just be agony to just sit on the cushion. It's like, oh my God, I've got to experience my own levels of tension and anxiety, and it's just like, get me away from this, get me away from this. You know, there's a reason why people don't do mindfulness. It's because actually, you know, the more unpleasant our experience, the more we want to push it away. Mm-hmm. So it's like quite often there's a hump to get over before we tap into the benefits. So for some people it's going to be meditation, and for others it's going to be much more like a mindful walk, or, you know, gardening or doing artwork, or but, you know, there's going to be some way in which everyone in this room could make a positive connection with consciously taking time to be present. Good. Hooray, we've got on to confession and rejoicing. I wasn't sure if we'd completely run out of time. Yes. Yeah, so both confession and rejoicing, yeah, it's like they both begin with recollection either of, oh, I've just acted in a way that was unskillful. I lost my sense of higher purpose or wanting to live for my values at that moment. Or else the opposite, I'll get on to rejoicing in a minute. Banti again, know your mind. Recollection is often about waking up to the fact that one has strayed away from where one really wants to be. Definitely my experience. So we've got groups every day this retreat, and basically, like, these groups are yours to do what you fancy in. But one of the things that we could explore in the groups is we could actually do confession in those groups. In the groups today, we can have a bit of a discussion about if we want to try doing that or not. So this isn't like the Spanish Inquisition. You will confess. Nobody's going to be threatened with a soft cushion or anything. I'm hoping people have seen that Monty Python sketch, otherwise that'll just be really random. Yeah. So probably, like, in the groups, I've got a handout, and we can just have a look at the practicalities of, like, you know, how, why, where, what, and all the rest of it. But here, I think I'll just kind of say a couple of things about, like, why, I suppose. So we have this amazing chapter at Tarok. It is just great. And most of what we do is confession, and we always start with, like, a confession space. And so this is what I do every Sunday night. I've got a life, me. So the things that I love about confession is it's like, well, there's this quality of honesty and openness where it's like I just go, and you know what? It's like I let people see all of me without, you know how our egos just do this sort of self-presenting thing? And we can either do self-presenting as, like, I'm a worm, or we can do self-presenting as, like, oh, well, I'm really good, I don't do this, but they do that. And I can just notice the bits of myself where I want to kind of, like, hide them under the bed and, like, don't let anybody see that. You know, I don't mind saying it, you know, I don't mind talking about that, but, like, oh, no, envy, no, not me, no. Other people have envy, but not me. And there's something that totally undercuts the whole ego project of just saying totally cleanly, you know what, last Tuesday I did this, and what was going on was that, and actually I really don't want to behave like that. and you just kind of, you know, you're just kind of opening everything up and just saying, oh look, and this is who I am. So it's a very strong act of trust. It's a very strong act of trust. So we do need to be in a circumstance that feels safe and talking to people that feels appropriate. But it can also build a very strong level of trust. And that's one of the most beautiful things about it, actually. It really builds spiritual community. And another aspect is forgiving ourselves. So part of this openness, it's like sometimes it's things where it's like, I don't want to admit to myself that I do that. I just don't want to look. This is why it's so linked with mindfulness. It's like sort of dragging out this sort of horrible little demon with clingy, grippy fingers from under the bed and saying, oh look, here you are. You're part of me too. And I can still love myself, and the people that I'm talking to will still love me, even though I've just shown them this horrible little demon with the clingy fingers. So again, it's something that really builds self-acceptance and just kind of like, well, yeah, this is what it is to be an unenlightened human being. And again, making confessions is karmic. It's very powerful karmic volition that really puts a weight behind, well, actually, I don't want to behave like that. You know, I really want to become a person who doesn't behave like that. So it is quite a transformative practice as well. Even though uncomfortable. So mostly I'm kind of like squirming and doing this when it's like my confession. And that's hri, this sense of positive shame. Like, kind of like, oh no, I can't believe I did that. That's, you know, so it is kind of like painful. But at the same time, it's clean. It's not guilt. It's not like I'm a bad person. It's more like my nature is blue sky. But what I'm doing is I'm talking about the acrid clouds of smoke that cloud that blue sky, that get in the way. So we're doing confession from a perspective that we are, like, basically people are, you know, intrinsically we are love and awareness, and stuff just gets in the way of that. And what a shame. It could not. So of course the downside. So when we can bring conditioning to confession, that means we're not approaching it in that we're blue sky. So anything about being disapproved of by the group, you know, I've got to confess to this, otherwise people will be cross with me, or I mustn't confess to that, or people won't love me anymore. And again, that's, you know, actually, like, you know, you could just explore that and sort of talk about feelings of like being disapproved of or being blamed, or, you know, sort of group stuff. Confession isn't being forgiven by authority or approval figures. Okay, I'm not going to make comments on Catholicism. But there's, you know, it's not kind of like, forgive me, Father, if I have sinned. Do you see what I mean? It's like, you know, it's not like anyone else can forgive you for that. It's not about that. It's about openness and like, well, actually, can I forgive myself for doing that? Can I choose how I want to behave next time? And just because we make a confession, that doesn't mean that action doesn't have consequences. Of course it does. You know, it's a karmic action that we did, and it'll still have all the consequences of that action. But what we're doing is we're saying, in the future, I don't want to do that action again. Do you get the difference? Okay, Banti, know your mind. When we confess to an unskillful action, we are confessing to a failure to live up to our own ideals. we are invoking a set of ethical and spiritual ideals that we have accepted for ourselves and that we share with other members of the spiritual community. These ideas are not imposed on us. There is no veiled threat behind them that if we don't try to live by them, we'll be in big trouble. It is this, in fact, that makes them truly ethical and spiritual ideals. So it's very important to try and distinguish between kind of like group acceptance and like, well, who do we want to be? What do we want to live by? What effect do we want to have? Really important to distinguish between those two. Okay, so I'm just going to finish with a little bit on rejoicing, which is just as important, if not more. and the Buddha actually says, in several places in the Pali Canon, with some gorgeous stories, which I don't have time to go into, although I would love to, and, you know, he actually kind of like sits people down and says, you know what, it would be a really good idea if Padma Bodhini, you rejoiced in your own ethics. And he also gives people a practice of recollecting their own generosity as a practice. So as in that practice, we sit down and we just basically say, hey, yesterday I helped out with the washing up and I didn't need to. Like, wasn't that great? I was really generous. People are giggling. Why should that be? You know, we can sit down and think, oh, you know what? There was a spider in the shrine room, and I didn't just think, oh, it'll get out. You know, I took the time and care to pick up the spider and put it out. How fantastic that I care about other living beings enough to care about what happens to a spider. Do you see what I mean? So it's like, actually, we can really take that on as a conscious recollection. And the Buddha's teaching this, he's not teaching this to people who are perfect, okay? So he's teaching it like to us, and he's saying, sit down and really consciously think, oh, I did that. How great, how fantastic. And this isn't, it's like boasting practice. and that's not blowing our own trumpet, or, well, maybe it is. Let's all blow our own trumpets. Why not? But just try doing it and notice the effect on your mind. And the effect on my mind is I relax, I feel happy, I feel joyful. And the effect of that is that I then want to do ethical actions. I then want to do generous actions. Whereas if we're continually thinking, oh, I fell short there, and I didn't do that, and I didn't do the other thing, actually, we'll just feel miserable and depressed and low and futile, and actually we won't choose to do those positive actions. So, rejoice. Rejoice in like all the ethical choices that we do make and we do take, and that will mean they will grow. How marvellous, how amazing. Okay, so I'm going to finish with, I think the Buddha should have the last word. This is from the Dhammapada, and the Buddha says, mindfulness is the way to the immortal, unmindfulness the way to death. Those who are unmindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead. Oh, I've done a typo. Those who are mindful do not die, whereas the unmindful are like the dead. That's what he meant. It's a good job I wasn't in charge of the oral tradition.